Chapter 39. The sail was raised, and any length of line that could be spared was used to tie the splitting hull together. With Maeve at the rudder, Giordino bailing like a crazy man, and Pitt sloshing the water in sheets over the side with his bare hands, the ruptured boat set its bow directly toward the small, low-lying island a few kilometers distant. At long last, they had visible proof that Pitt's navigation had paid off. The mind-drugging fatigue, the overwhelming exhaustion, had dropped from Pitt and Giordino like a heavy rock. They entered a zone where they were no longer themselves, a psychological zone where another world of stress and suffering had no meaning. It didn't matter that their bodies would pay heavily in agony later, as long as their sheer determination and refusal to accept defeat carried them across the gap separating the boat from the beckoning shore. They were aware of the pain screaming from their shoulders and backs, but the awareness was little more than an abstract protest from the mind. It was as if the torment belonged elsewhere. The wind filled the sail, shoving the boat on a course for the solitary outcrop on the horizon. But the heartless sea was not about to release them from its grip. The current fought them, forking as it ran up against the shore and flowing in a loop past the outer limits of the island, threatening to push them back into the vast nothingness of the Pacific.
"I think we're being swept around it," Maeve said fearfully.
Facing forward as he frantically scooped the surging water out of the boat, Pitt seldom took his eyes off the nearing island. At first he thought they were seeing only one island, but as they approached within 2 kilometers, he saw it was two. An arm of the sea, about 100 meters in width, separated one from the other. He could also make out what appeared to be a tidal current running through the gap between the islands. By the wind streaks on the surface and the spraying foam, Pitt could tell that the following breeze had shifted even more in their favor, blowing the boat on a sharper angle across the unfriendly current. That was a plus, he thought optimistically. The fact that the water this far south was too cold for coral reefs to form and wait in ambush to tear them to shreds didn't hurt either. As he and Giordino fought the incoming water, they became conscious of a sullen thunder that seemed to grow louder. A quick pause and their eyes locked as they realized that it was the unique sound of surf pounding against rock cliffs. The waves had turned murderous and were drawing the boat ever closer into a fatal embrace. The castaway's happy anticipation of setting foot on dry land again suddenly turned to a fear of being crushed in a thrashing sea. Instead of a safe haven, what Pitt saw was a forbidding pair of rocks jutting abruptly from the sea, surrounded and struck by the onslaught of massive breakers. These were not tropical atolls with inviting white sand beaches and waving friendly natives, the stuff of Bally High, blessed by heaven and lush plant life. There was no sign of habitation on either island, no smoke, no structures of any kind to be seen. Barren, windswept, and desolate, they seemed a mysterious outpost of lava rock, their only vegetation a few clusters of low, non-flowering plants and strange-looking trees whose growth appeared stunted. He could not believe that he was in a war with unyielding stone and water for the third time since he had found and rescued Maeve on the Antarctic Peninsula. For a brief instant, his thoughts raced back to the near escape of the Polar Queen and the flight from Kunghit Island with Mason Broadmoor. Both times he had mechanical power to carry him clear. Now he was fighting a watery burial on a little waterlogged boat with a sail not much bigger than a blanket. The master seaman's first consideration when encountering rough seas, he recalled reading somewhere, was the preservation of the stability of his boat. The good sailor should not allow his boat to take on water, which would affect her buoyancy. He wished that whoever wrote that was sitting beside him. "Unless you see a stretch of beach to land on," Pitt shouted at Maeve, "steer for the breach between the islands." Maeve's lovely features, drawn and burned from the sun, became set and tense. She nodded silently, tightly gripped the rudder lines, and focused every bit of her strength on the task. The jagged walls that climbed above the crashing surf looked more menacing with each passing minute. Water was pouring alarmingly into the boat.
Giordino ignored the approaching upheaval and concentrated on keeping the boat from sinking under them. To stop bailing now could have fatal consequences. 10 seconds of uninterrupted flow of seawater through the damaged boat, and they would sink 500 meters from shore. Struggling helpless in the water, if the sharks didn't get them, the surge and rocks would. He kept bailing, never missing a beat, his faith and trust entirely in the hands of Pitt and Maeve. Pitt studied the cadence of the waves as friction with the bottom slope caused them to rise and slow down, measuring the break of the crests ahead and astern and timing their speed. The wave period shortened to roughly 9 seconds and was moving at approximately 22 knots. The swells were beating in on an oblique angle to that of the rugged shoreline, causing the waves to break sharply as they refracted in a wide turn. Pitt did not need an old clipper ship captain to tell him that with their extremely limited sail power, there was little opportunity for maneuvering their way into the slot. His other fear was that of backwash swinging off the shoreline of both islands and turning the channel entrance into a maelstrom. He could feel the pressure of the next wave surging beneath his knees, which were pressed into the bottom of the hull, and he judged its mass by the vibrations as it rumbled under him. The poor boat was being cruelly thrust into a tumult her designers never intended. Pitt did not dare put out the makeshift sea anchor as demanded by most sailors' manuals when traveling through violent seas. With no engine, he believed it in their best interests to run with the waves. The drag of the anchor would most certainly pull the boat apart as the immense pressure from the waves drove them forward. He turned to Maeve. "Try and keep us in the darkest blue of the water." "I'll do my best," she replied bravely. The roar of the breakers came with a steady rolling beat, and soon they saw as well as heard the hiss of the spray as it burst into the sky. Without direct and manual control, they were helpless. The whims of the restless sea took them wherever it desired. The surge was building ever higher now. On closer inspection, the slot between the rock outcroppings seemed like an insidious trap, a silent siren beckoning them to a false refuge. Too late to sail out to sea and around the islands. They were committed, and there could be no turning back. The islands and the frothing witch's cauldron along their malevolent shores became hidden behind the backs of the waves that passed under the boat. A fresh gust of wind sprang up and thrust them toward a rock-walled cleft that offered their only chance at survival. The seas became more nervous the nearer they approached. So did Pitt when he calculated the crest of the waves to be almost 10 meters in height when they curled and broke. Maeve struggled with the rudder to control their course, but the boat did not answer her helm and quickly became unmanageable. They were totally caught in the surge. "Hold on!" Pitt shouted. He took a quick glance astern and noted their position in regard to the sea's vertical movement. He knew that wave speed was highest just before reaching its crest. The breakers were rolling in like huge trucks in a convoy. The boat dropped into a trough, but their luck held as the swell broke just after passing them, and then they were riding on the back of the following wave at what seemed like breakneck speed. The surf was torn up and hurled in every direction as the wind whipped off the crests. The boat fell back only to be struck by the next sea as it rose under them to a height of 8 meters, curled and collapsed over their heads. The boat did not broach, nor did it pitch pole or even capsize. It landed flat and was thrown downward, crashing into the trough with a huge splash. They were under a literal wall of hydraulic pressure. It felt as though the boat were being transported underwater by an out-of-control elevator. The total submersion seemed to take minutes, but it could not have lasted more than a few seconds. Pitt kept his eyes open and saw Maeve blurred and looking like a surreal vision in the liquid void, her face remarkably serene, her blonde hair flowing up and out behind her. As he watched, she suddenly became lucent and distinct as they broke into the sunshine again. 3 or more seas rolled over them with diminishing force, and then they were through the breakers and into calmer water. Pitt snapped his head around, spitting out the salt water he had taken in by not closing his mouth tightly, his wavy black hair whipping off the water droplets in glistening streaks. "We're through the worst," he yelled happily. "We've gained the channel." The surge that swept into the channel had been reduced to rolling waves no higher than the average doorway. Amazingly, the boat was still afloat and in one piece. Through the grinding ferocity of the crashing breakers, it still somehow held together. The only apparent damage was to the sail and paddle mast, which had been torn away but were floating nearby, still attached to the boat by a line. Giordino had never stopped bailing, even when he was sitting in water up to his chest. He sputtered and wiped the salt from his eyes and continued throwing water over the side like there was no tomorrow. The hull was now completely cracked in two and barely held together by the hurriedly attached nylon lines and the clamps connecting the buoyancy floats. Giordino finally conceded defeat as he found himself sitting up to his armpits in seawater. He looked around dazedly, his breath labored, his mind deadened by exhaustion. "What now?" he mumbled. Before Pitt answered, he dipped his face in the water and peered at the bottom of the channel. The visibility was exceptional, though blurred without a face mask, and he could see sand and rock only 10 meters below. Schools of vividly colored fish swam about leisurely, taking no notice of the strange creature floating overhead. "No sharks in here," he said thankfully. "They seldom swim through breakers," said Maeve through a spasm of coughing. She was sitting with her arms stretched out and draped over the stern buoyancy tube. The current through the channel was carrying them closer to the northern island. Solid ground was only 30 meters away. Pitt looked at Maeve and broke into a crooked grin. "I'll bet you're a strong swimmer." "You're talking to an Aussie," she said coolly, and then added, "Remind me sometime to show you my butterfly and backstroke medals." Alice played out. "Can you tow him to shore?" "The least I can do for the man who kept us out of the mouths of sharks." Pitt gestured toward the nearest shoreline. There was no sandy beach, but the rock flattened out into a shelf as it met the water. "The way looks clear to climb on firm ground." "And you?" She pulled back her hair with both hands, wringing away the water. "Do you want me to come back for you?" He shook his head. "I've saved myself for a more important effort."
"What effort?"
"Club Med hasn't built a resort here yet. We still need all the food supplies we have in hand. I'm going to tow what's left of the boat and the goodies therein." Pitt helped roll Giordino over the half-sunken buoyancy tubes into the water, where he was grasped under the chin lifeguard style by Maeve. She stroked strongly to shore, pulling Giordino behind her. Pitt watched for a moment until he saw Giordino grin shiftily and lift one hand in a bye wave. "The nefarious little devil," Pitt thought. "He's enjoying a free ride." Splicing and knotting the rigging back into one long nylon line, Pitt attached it to the half-sunken boat and tied the other end around his waist. Then he swam toward shore. The dead weight was too much to simply drag behind him. He would stop in the water, heave on the line, gain a short distance, and then repeat the process. The current helped by nudging the boat around in an arc toward shore. After traveling 20 meters, he finally felt firm ground beneath his feet. Now he could use the added leverage to pull the boat onto the rock shelf. He was wearily grateful when Maeve and Giordino both waded in and helped him tow it ashore. "You recovered quickly," he said to Giordino.
"My recuperative powers are the marvel of doctors everywhere."
"I think he suckered me," said Maeve, feigning hostility. "Nothing like the feel of terra firma to rejuvenate one's soul." Pitt sat down and rested, too tired to dance for joy at being off the water. He slowly rose to his knees before standing up. For a few moments, he had to hold onto the ground to steady himself. The motion of nearly 2 weeks bobbing about in a small boat had affected his balance. The world spun, and the entire island rocked as if it floated on the sea. Maeve immediately sat back down, while Giordino planted both feet firmly on the rock and clutched a nearby tree with thick foliage. After a few minutes, Pitt rose shakily to his feet and made a few faltering steps. Not having walked since the abduction in Wellington, he found his legs and ankles were unfeeling and stiff. Only after he'd staggered about 20 meters and back did his joints begin to loosen and operate as they should. They hauled the boat farther onto the rocks and rested for a few hours before dining on their dried fish. Washed down by rainwater, they found standing in several concave impressions in the rock. Their energies restored, they began to survey the island. There was precious little to see. The whole island and its neighbor across the channel had the appearance of solid piles of lava rock that had exploded from the ocean floor, building over the eons until reaching the surface before being eroded into low mounds. If the water had been fully transparent and the islands viewed down to their base on the seafloor, they might have been compared to the great dramatic spires of Monument Valley, Arizona, rising like islands in a desert sea. Giordino paced off the width from shore to shore and announced that their refuge was only 130 meters across. The highest point was a flattened plateau no more than 10 meters in height. The landmass curved into a tear shape that stretched north and south, with the windward arc facing the west. From rounded end to spiked point, the length was no more than a kilometer. Surrounded by natural seawalls that defied the swells, the island had the appearance of a fortress under constant attack. A short distance away, they discovered the shattered remains of a boat that lay high and dry in a small inlet that was carved out of the rock by the sea, evidently driven there by large storm waves. She was a fair-sized sailboat, rolled over on her port side, half her hull and keel torn away from an obvious collision with rocks. She must have been a pretty boat at one time, Pitt imagined. Her upper works had been painted light blue with orange undersides. Though the masts were gone, the deckhouse looked undamaged and intact. The three of them approached and studied it before peering inside. "A grand, seaworthy little boat," observed Pitt. "About 12 meters, well-built, with a teak hull." "A Bermuda ketch," said Maeve, running her hands over the worn and sun-bleached teak planking. "A fellow student at the Marine Lab on St. Croix had one. We used to island hop with it. She sailed remarkably well." Giordino stared at the paint and caulking on the hull appraisingly. "Been here 20, maybe 30 years, judging by her condition. I hope whoever became marooned on this desolate spot was rescued," Maeve said quietly. Pitt swept a hand around the barrenness. "Certainly no sane sailor would go out of his way to visit here." Maeve's eyes brightened, and she snapped her fingers as if something deep in her memory had surfaced. "They're called the Tits." Pitt and Giordino glanced at each other as if not believing what they had heard. "You did say Tits," Giordino inquired. "An old Australian tale about a pair of islands that look like a woman's breasts. They are said to disappear and reappear like Brigadoon." "I hate to be a debunker of down-under myths," said Pitt facetiously, "but this rock pile hasn't gone anywhere for the last 1,000,000 years. "They're not shaped like any mammary glands I've ever seen," muttered Giordino. She gave both men a pouty look. "I only know what I heard about a pair of legendary islands south of the Tasman Sea." Hoisted by Giordino, Pitt climbed aboard the canted hull and crawled through the hatch into the deckhouse. "She's been stripped clean," he called out from the inside. "Everything that wasn't screwed down has been removed. Check the transom and see if she has a name." Maeve walked around to the stern and stared up at the faded letters that were barely readable. "Dancing Dorothy. Her name was Dancing Dorothy." Pitt climbed down from the yacht's cockpit. "A search is in order to locate the supplies taken from the boat. The crew may have left behind articles we can put to use." Resuming their exploration, it took little more than half an hour to skirt the entire coast of the tear-shaped little island. Then they worked their way inland. They separated and strung out in a loose line to cover more territory. Maeve was the first to spot an axe half buried in the rotting trunk of a grotesquely shaped tree. Giordino pulled it loose and held it up. "This should come in handy." "Odd-looking tree," said Pitt, eyeing its trunk. "I wonder what it's called." "Tasmanian myrtle," Maeve clarified. "Actually, it's a species of false beech. They can grow as high as 60 meters. But there isn't enough sandy loam here to support their root system, so all the trees we see on the island look like they've been dwarfed." They continued to search around carefully. A few minutes later, Pitt stumbled onto a small ravine that opened onto a flat ledge on the lee side of the island. Lodged in one side of a rock wall, he spied the head of a brass gaff for landing fish. A few meters beyond, they came to a jumbled stack of logs in the form of a hut, with a boat's mast standing beside it. The structure was about 3 meters wide by 4 meters long. The roof of logs intermixed with branches was undamaged by the elements. The unknown builder had raised a sound dwelling. Outside the hut was a wealth of abandoned supplies and equipment. A battery and the corroded remains of a radio telephone, a direction-finding set, a wireless receiver for obtaining weather bulletins and time signals for rating a chronometer, a pile of rusty food cans that had been opened and emptied, an intact teakwood dinghy equipped with a small outboard motor and miscellaneous nautical hardware, dishes and eating utensils, a few pots and pans, a propane stove, and other various and sundry items from the wrecked boat. Strewn around the shore, still discernible, were bones of fish. "The former tenants left a messy campground," said Giordino, kneeling to examine a small gas-driven generator for charging the boat's batteries, which had operated the electronic navigational instruments and radio equipment scattered about the campsite. "Maybe they're still in the hut," murmured Maeve. Pitt smiled at her. "Why don't you go in and see?" She shook her head. "Not me. Entering dark and creepy places is man's work." Women are indeed enigmatic creatures, Pitt thought. After all the dangers Maeve had encountered in the past few weeks, she couldn't bring herself to walk into the hut. He bent under the low doorway and stepped inside.